Yeah, we'll do that silver story, of course, but spoiler alert, it is not the same as GameStop. We'll talk about the next relief package, too, assuming there is one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the very first day of February. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. Let's stipulate right up front here that it's still early going in the politics of the next round of virus relief. The president has his plan, $1.9 trillion benefits extending through September. Senate Republicans now have their plan, $618 billion benefits through June. So there are scope and scale differences between the two sides. They met today at the White House, by the way. But there is also kind of a philosophical difference.
There's a tradition in the United States that you should sort of designate certain people who need access to government services or need government income support, what we call means testing. In other words, trying to target assistance to the people who have low incomes or otherwise are most in financial need.
That's J.W. Mason. He's an associate professor of economics at John Jay College at the City University of New York. And targeting the relief is what Republicans say they want to do. Get the money to the people who need it most.
That sounds appealing, but the first problem with that is that it's not so straightforward to identify who is in the greatest need.
Jessica Sheeter is a federal tax policy fellow. She's at the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy.
It's always important that, you know, the more complicated we make the conditions, I think it can sometimes detract from, you know, either the efficiency of that aid getting out, or it ends up being too specific. And we unintentionally leave folks out who actually we'd like to get cash into the pockets of.
We told you all that. And remember, the caveat here is we don't know how the politics of this thing are going to shake out. But we told you that so we could tell you this. The Congressional Budget Office was out with its twice-a-year economic outlook today, and it is important to say here the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. And here's what the CBO had to say. They figure gross domestic product, that is, the size of the economy, is going to be back to where it was at the beginning of last year by this coming summer, mid-2021. So we've lost, if you think about it, a year and a half. More to the point, though, of the politics of any next relief package. The CBO says the American labor market, that is people having jobs, isn't going to get back to where it was until 2024. Okay, silver. First of all, what? I can't tell you the last time silver was anywhere near the business headlines, years at least. But now, in the wake of the social media-driven pyrotechnics in GameStop, AMC, Nokia, and what have you shares, a corner of Reddit has taken aim at precious metals. At one point today, silver was up more than 10% to an 8-year high. But that gets you to the and second of all part of this story, because as Marketplace's Andy Euler explains, silver's recent popularity is a whole lot more complicated than just, it's the next GameStop.
The thing about GameStop is that there was no question that many hedge funds were shorting it, betting that its value would go down. And retail investors have been undermining that position, driving shares up. The idea is to do the same thing with silver, but
the problem with silver is that the starting point was, well, there's been this long-standing manipulation of the price, it's been suppressed.
Philip Newman is managing director of the consultancy Metals Focus. He says that was not happening.
We just don't believe that the price has been manipulated. And therefore, I guess ultimately, there was no smoking gun on the other side to try and draw out.
In fact, he says the majority of big banks and money managers have been long on silver since at least the middle of 2019, meaning they were betting on silver prices rising. Another way this isn't GameStop Part 2, silver is tangible. It's useful in manufacturing, and it has a real future. Will Rind is founder of the asset management firm Granite Shares.
Commodities are something that you can increase the supply of. And so with some of these small cap stocks, the reason why they can get really squeezed is because you can't increase the amount of shares outstanding.
With silver, he says, mines can increase production, and a spike in price also leads to silver recycling, people selling their grandmother's flatware and jewelry. Adrian Ash is director of research at Bullion Vault, an online trading platform for precious metals. He says today was a record day for new account openings, but
I hope that people don't get disappointed too fast. I hope they also go out and they do their own research. They start looking at the market more broadly. They start doing their own due diligence about how they're going to buy and what's the best way and what are the risks and the issues.
Because, he says, the silver market is still volatile. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Stop me if you've heard this one before. It's almost infrastructure week again. The Biden administration is expected to roll out a longer-term recovery plan this month. $2 trillion over 4 years to build and repair everything from roads and bridges to affordable housing to broadband networks. That would be sweet, sweet music to the ears of the construction industry. The latest numbers out today show construction spending overall was up last month, almost 6% compared to a year earlier. But you take out residential construction, all that home building and remodeling that one Amy Scott has been telling us all about, and it's a whole nother story. Here's Amy.
For industries that are hurting in the pandemic, hotels, office and retail space, and transportation, construction is down. Ken Simonson, chief economist with the Associated General Contractors of America, says a massive infrastructure spending bill would help.
But frankly, like Charlie Brown going after that football, we saw Lucy pull it away all through the last 4.5 years.
Former President Trump also promised a big infrastructure package that never materialized. Kevin DeGood with the Center for American Progress says the need has only grown due to lost tax revenue.
So the money coming from Washington really has to do two things. It has to backfill what would otherwise have been spent under normal economic conditions by state and local governments, as well as then provide a boost on top of that.
Then there's the question of who's going to do all the building and paving and wiring. The industry is facing a long-term shortage of skilled workers that dates back to the last recession, which is why Grant Schmelzer, who represents electrical contractors in the Mid-Atlantic region, has mixed feelings about a sudden surge in demand.
Definitely excitement, definitely hesitation in the same breath due to labor shortages.
He says any infrastructure plan will have to come with more recruiting and training. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Hey, do me a favor. When you get up tomorrow morning, fire up the live stream. Check out David Brancaccio and the gang, the Marketplace Morning Report. Everything you need to know to start your business day. Much as it's early days yet in relief negotiations, it's early days, too, for the Biden administration overall. And so there are still a whole lot of open positions. Who gets which nomination always involves politics and connections and messaging and all of that. And on this program, we try real hard to stay out of all of that. But there is a nomination in the economic policy world that's been generating quite a bit of debate of late. Who ought to run the office of the Comptroller of the Currency? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
The candidates to run the nation's top banking regulator are reportedly Mirza Baradaran, an expert on banking and the racial wealth gap, and Michael Barr, who served in the Treasury Department of the Obama and Clinton administrations. Advocates of both are pushing hard because, says Ellen Seidman at the Urban Institute,
the OCC regulates 66% of the banking assets in the United States. So it has an outside influence on how those banks, and in fact, really all banks, operate.
It will also play a key role in the Biden administration's efforts to address economic inequality. Aaron Lockwood teaches political science at the University of California, Irvine.
The OCC is tasked with enforcing two pieces of legislation that are pretty central to the racial wealth gap and racial inequality. The first is the Fair Housing Act,
which is supposed to prevent housing discrimination. The other is the Community Reinvestment Act, which guides what national banks do in minority and low-income communities. Buzz Roberts runs the National Association of Affordable Housing Lenders.
The new Comptroller of the Currency is going to have to take another look at those rules and decide whether and how to re-engage with the other banking agencies as well as other stakeholders.
Everyone from consumers to banks to industry groups and advocates, many of whom are campaigning publicly and privately for their candidate of choice. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
My dear friend would always say, you have to change hearts and minds. And when he used to say that, I would roll my eyes.
Yeah, I kind of get that. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 229 points today. 0.75% closed at 30,211. The NASDAQ up 332 points. That's more than 2.5% there. Finished at 13,403. The S&P 500 jumped 59 points, 1.6%. Ended things at 3,773. That's your palindromic entry for today's markets. Today's events on the silver market that Euler was telling us about. Man, shares in Comstock Mining hit pay dirt. Ticker symbol LODE, L-O-D-E. Kind of love that one. Pocketed almost 117% today. Wheaton Precious Metals Corporation gleaned 5.3%. Bonds barely moved. Yield on the 10-year Treasury, 1.07%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As I said up at the top of the program, it is early days yet in the next round of coronavirus relief. We don't know how big it's going to be and when that money is going to show up in the economy. What we do know is that some of the money from the last relief bill that passed just before Christmas hasn't shown up yet in the economy. It extended unemployment benefits for millions of people and gave everybody on unemployment an extra $300 a week through March. That was the plan. Marketplace's Samantha Fields explains what's going on in reality.
Kierica Shields doesn't know how she's getting by right now.
I honestly don't even know. Like, I honestly don't. I really have no income, like literally none.
The last time she got an unemployment check from the state of Georgia was in early December.
I've still been claiming every week. I just haven't received anything.
Tons of people around the country are having the same experience, says Michelle Evermore at the National Employment Law Project. Even though they are still eligible for unemployment, their benefits have stopped.
These are people who applied right at the beginning of the pandemic.
People who lost their jobs in March and have been on unemployment ever since. Most of them were on the verge of exhausting their benefits in December when the new relief package became law and extended unemployment benefits for people who were about to lose them. But Evermore says it happened too late.
States had to scramble to reprogram in time to keep benefits flowing smoothly. And in most states, there was a disruption in paying benefits.
Partly because most state unemployment computer systems are antiquated, and also because the relief package changed some of the rules for federal unemployment programs, and states were waiting for guidance on how to run them.
And all of that is resulting in a huge interruption in payments for a lot of folks.
Rachel Deutsch is an attorney at the Center for Popular Democracy. She says she's been hearing from people across the country who still are not getting their benefits.
It depends on the state, but we are definitely hearing from quite a lot of people, especially in the states that are sort of notorious for underinvesting in their administrative systems.
Including Georgia, where Kierica Shields is still waiting for her benefits to kick back in. Michelle Evermore at the National Employment Law Project says people should keep filing weekly unemployment claims, and eventually they should get a big check with all those weeks of back pay. But in some states, she says, that may take a while.
If somebody's benefits stop before Christmas, they may be among the last to get their benefits turned back on again.
It's been more than 6 weeks since Kierica Shields got her last unemployment check, and she doesn't know how much longer she can go. She's 29 and a single mom with 4 kids between 1 and 11. Before the pandemic, she was working full-time as a home hospice nurse and studying to get another nursing degree. But she had to quit both in the spring to stay home and take care of her kids. Now she's getting desperate.
I got a call from my rent office saying that I needed to pay before the first, so they're going to have to file an eviction. My gas bill is saying this is your final disconnect notice. Light bill saying the same thing. I don't know.
Shields paid part of her rent and utilities with her credit card.
To show them that I'm trying.
And to keep the heat and the lights on for her kids.
But now I can't use my credit card at all because it's maxed out.
And she doesn't know what else to do.
I'm hoping that I get a stimulus, or I'm hoping I can file my taxes already or something to catch me up, because I literally have nothing.
Her kids are finally back in school and daycare, so she's hoping she can go back to work at her old job.
Because I can't keep waiting on this unemployment.
But to do that, she needs to find a way to buy a car, because the only job her employer has for her is an hour and a half away. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
President Biden signed an executive order last week, what he called a first step in addressing systemic problems in the criminal justice system. He ordered the Justice Department to stop using private prisons. Those systemic problems the president was talking about, problems that go well beyond the 2.3 million people currently in jails and prisons in the United States, is what Reuben Jonathan Miller, he's an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Chicago, it's what he talks about in his new book. It's called Halfway Home, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. Professor Miller, welcome to the program, sir.
Glad to be here.
I want to start with the subtitle of this book, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. I want you to tell me about that, and I want you to use your brother and how you lived this experience.
So we've focused a lot of attention on jails and prisons. And what I was interested in writing about and revealing is how mass incarceration has changed the nature of social life in our everyday relationships. So how it shows up in, for example, my relationship with my brother, mm-hmm. Who's been in and out of prison, how it shows up across the dinner table, how it shows up between a mother and her child, a grandmother and her grandson, who she's trying to help. And so this, for me, is the afterlife. It's the lingering effects of incarceration in places that we might not expect.
And one of the ways that shows up, you say in this book, is that people who are living in this afterlife of incarceration get by, and this is a great phrase, I love it, on an economy of favors.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah. So beginning in about 1980, there were changes in liability law that made it so that landlords, employers, licensing officials, et cetera, could be sued if they rented an apartment to or hired somebody with a criminal record. And the way that they took on that change in law and policy is they evicted people with criminal records. Mm-hmm. They refused to hire people with criminal records. In fact, one change in policy that started in 1996 made it so that if someone with a criminal record so much as visited, the person who owned the apartment could be put out for letting them visit. And so what this does is it makes it so it's impossible, nearly impossible, for somebody with a record to find sustainable employment or housing or many of the things that they need to get by to meet their basic human needs. And at the same time, it makes them the least desirable candidates to help. It makes them somebody who you don't want to help because you can be harmed if you help them. They have to convince you to do them the favor of hiring them for a job that they're suitable for, leasing them an apartment for which they're well qualified, because of the legal changes that we've enacted during the age of mass incarceration.
What do you make then of, just to get to the news of the, you know, of the new administration, what do you make of the Biden administration's orders on private prisons, which are, we should say, just a small part of the prison system in this country, and also some of the thoughts of new people in power about incarceration in this economy?
I think it's a positive step in the right direction in how we think about the problems that we face. But turning every private prison, moving people from a private prison to a public prison doesn't reduce the number of people in prison, and it certainly doesn't address the problem of the 19.6 million people with felony records who live on the outside of American jails or prisons.
Which seems to me to suggest that you believe while there are legitimate policy and law questions that we need to address, there's a whole slice of this that's subjective and more hearts and minds than law and policy.
It's interesting. My dear friend, Ronald Simpson Bay, who's in the book, would always say, I tell people you have to change hearts and minds. And when he used to say that, I would roll my eyes. I'd say hearts and minds, it's a legal problem. This is a problem of the law. This right. So there are 45,000 laws, policies, and administrative sanctions that target people with criminal records. But he says this, that's important too. He says, but if you don't change hearts and minds, every time you get a new administration, you face the threat of them wiping away any progress that you've made with the stroke of a pen. Mm-hmm. So there also has to be a transformation in how we think about people who've caused us harm and the place that we think that they're supposed to take up in society after they've done their time. Mm-hmm. So this is absolutely a both and response to this problem.
So let me, on the way out here, get you back to where we started, which is your brother the afterlife. And I'm sure you've given much thought over your life and certainly specific while writing this book about how he wound up there and you wound up where you are. But tell me the story, would you, of trying to find him housing after he got out of prison?
Yeah, you know, it's striking. So one of the mandates is that you must have a place to parole to or to report to if you're to be released on probation, which is early release from jail or prison. And so I had to find some place for him to be. Now, I lived in faculty housing. Now, I've done quite a bit in my own life to force my way into the middle class. You know, did the education route. You know, served in the military. You know, did a bunch of things over my lifetime to ensure that my family was okay. But I was living in faculty housing. And so in faculty housing, you know, you can't have people with criminal records living in your home. Right. So it didn't matter that I was, you know, a professor at a pretty prestigious university, that I was myself middle class, that he couldn't stay with me or my family would be evicted. So we made a connection with a dear friend who said he would rent him his apartment. But the dear friend ended up renting that apartment to someone else.
Oh, man.
And so,
maybe not such a dear friend, but anyway, go on.
These are all real questions. Yeah. And so we're scrambling to find him a place to stay. And so we eventually land on him staying in the apartment with the dear friend.
Oh, man.
And so the probation officer comes out to inspect the apartment, and I get a text message from him telling me that the probation placement has failed because my dear friend had two dogs.
Wow.
And people with felony records can't live in places that have large dogs. So this was the struggle.
Yeah. And out of that and a bunch more, I imagine, comes a book called Halfway Home by Reuben Jonathan Miller.
That's right.
He's at the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The book, one more time, Halfway Home, Race, Punishment, and the Afterlife of Mass Incarceration. Professor Miller, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
God, thanks so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, in which, is it just me or is it too soon? The whole GameStop thing is still playing out, but Hollywood apparently is already banking on it. We are told today of at least two deals that have been signed, one by author Ben Mezrich with MGM for a movie based on a book that he hasn't written yet, tentatively titled The Anti-Social Network. Mezrich wrote the book about that other social network that became a movie called The Social Network, that we all know is Facebook. Netflix has another project in the works, we're told. And having heard myself say all that, and with this news tidbit, that Robinhood, the trading platform at the center of all this, has taken another $2.4 billion from investors to cover its cash crunch, I'm going to say it's too soon. All right, we're going, but not before we give you your Monday moment of economic context. Another tidbit or two from that Congressional Budget Office economic outlook we mentioned up at the top of the program. First of all, Its projections about growth and the labor market don't include any potential new relief package, so that's important and potentially promising. Also, it's assuming that the Federal Reserve is going to keep interest rates where they are, which is zero, until 2024. So now you know. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.